And we've had that stress test recently, not of course just in New Zealand, but all around the world. We've had the toughest economic test since the Depression. And you can see from our point of view, our picture on it today when we announced our official cash rate review. It's a story about a New Zealand macro economy that's pulling out of recession in a very fragile way, and with a banking system that has worked well but has also been through very difficult times. It's times like this that central banks know how much they need their friends and their colleagues around the world, and we've always been very lucky to have very good cooperative relations with the important banks for us and the important regulators for us. And in that sense, I would like to welcome tonight two of our visitors who have flown in this afternoon. That's Glenn Stevens, who is Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia here tonight, and John Laker, who is Chairman of the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority tonight as well, APRA. The Reserve Bank was set up in, as I said, 1934, August, in response to questions from New Zealand government about better ways to manage the economy, which were responded to by the Bank of England, who sent out a senior advisor, Sir Otto Neumeyer, who came to New Zealand and gave us the benefit of some advice which was ultimately acted on in the setting up of the Reserve Bank. Since then, we've had the advantage of continued advice and assistance and cooperation and staff movements and intellectual interchange with the Bank of England, and more recently with the Financial Services Authority, and indeed in a particular way with the London School of Economics as well. And for that reason, we couldn't have asked a more relevant person to come and talk to us on our 75th anniversary, and that is Howard Davies. It's my pleasant job to introduce him to you. Howard has degrees from Oxford and later Stanford University. He's had a very interesting career, starting off in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, working in the UK Treasury, working for McKinsey & Co., working as a special advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, becoming in the late 80s controller of the Audit Commission in Britain. In the early 90s, he moved and became Director General of a very large and important organisation in British life, which is the Confederation of British Industries. Just as it's starting to look like this man can't hold a job down for long, he gets pulled into the Bank of England, where he becomes Deputy Governor with a focus right across all the range of activities there. And only 2 years later, he becomes the founding chair of the new FSA authority, Financial Services Authority, which is set up by the new government as a new way to regulate the financial services across the board in Britain. And this is path-breaking stuff. Part of his job there is to integrate no fewer than 9 agencies that are already doing some of these things. Howard is now Director of the London School of Economics, a very major job as well. Quite apart from these mainline positions he's held a number of other offices. He's been a non-executive director or advisor to a whole range of major financial institutions in Britain, and more recently he's been an important advisor to the Chinese Banking Regulatory Commission, and then more recently the Chinese Securities Regulatory Commission, and also an advisor to the Government Investment Corporation of Singapore. He has published very widely. He's particularly known for 2 recent books, one called Chancellor's Tales, and another only last year on global financial regulation, The Essential Guide. But this isn't enough to keep him occupied, and in between times he's been a columnist for the Financial Times and the Times and the Times Higher Educational Supplement and Management Today. Howard has contributed hugely into the community as well. He's been a founding chairman of the Employers Forum on Age to combat ageism in the workforce. He's a patron of Working Families, which lobbies on behalf of parents in the workplace. He's been a recent chairman of the Tate Gallery. He's on the governing body of the Royal Academy of Music, and because he's clearly got nothing to do in the evenings, he recently became judge of the Man Booker Prize for Fiction, thus allowing him to read hundreds of books. It looks like weekends are also a bit of a problem because Howard, I understand, is a member of and plays for two cricket clubs in England. It's not surprising that in the millennium year the Queen decided to knight Howard, and his talk tonight is in a way a response to a royal question, although he's put it in his own words. It's my great pleasure to introduce Howard Davies to you tonight. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Alan, for that kind introduction. And thanks to the Reserve Bank for giving me the opportunity to come over here to join in the celebrations of your 75th birthday. I have to say, though, I arrived yesterday and late last night I really wondered if I was going to be able to come and speak to you because I was just having a quiet pint of original in a bar when I was set on by four New Zealand rugby supporters who clearly mistook me for a Springbok forward. I had no trouble getting rid of them, of course, but I do expect a letter of apology from the Prime Minister for this unfortunate circumstance. Also, I have to say I'm very flattered by the number of people who are here and also by the quality. I looked through the list of people and I looked and discovered that 40% of the people here this evening have a PhD from the London School of Economics, which I gather is something which every New Zealand public servant must have. But there are, apart from that, three particular reasons why I was delighted to accept the invitation, and none of them was the opportunity to visit New Zealand during your winter in the middle of a Home Ashes series. But the first is that, as Alan said, the Bank of England was, if you like, midwife to the birth of the Reserve Bank 75 years ago. The second is that there is a close link between New Zealand and the LSE. One of the most celebrated economists in the LSE's history, Bill Phillips, he of the Phillips Curve, was a New Zealander, and some years back the school gave New Zealand one of the Phillips machines, which illustrates in a vivid way the relationship between inflation and unemployment. You can see it, in fact, in the Reserve Bank Museum. We don't now think of that relationship quite in the way that Bill Phillips did, but many of his insights are still highly relevant. And the third reason is that over the last year I've been working on another book about the future of central banking, and the Reserve Bank has a particular place in the history of central banking in the last 20 years as the originator of inflation targeting, a policy framework which has now spread around the world. More than 20 other countries have adopted it. And in that book, I shall argue that inflation targeting now needs some further development in the light of the crisis, and I'll come on to that in a moment. But there's no doubt that the Reserve Bank has been a highly influential organisation internationally under Don Brash and Alan Bullard. In central banking, as in rugby union, New Zealand punches above its weight, only metaphorically in the first case, sometimes literally in the second. The subject matter I've chosen for this evening is, however, the financial crisis itself, and particularly the big question which remains under debate, who done it? Now, when, as Alan referred to the Queen, and when she opened a new building at the LSE last November, I'd lined up one of our professors of economics to show her just three slides as part of a tour on the financial crisis. The first one showed the growth of securitizations, particularly in the subprime market. The second one showed the price collapse. And the third one actually showed the consequences on funds flows into emerging markets. And the Queen rather acutely listened to this for the statutory sort of 4 minutes and said, "That's awful," which as a two-word summary of the crisis is about as, you know, good as you can get, but then did completely floor the professor with the question, why did nobody see it coming? Which is altogether more difficult and very much above my pay grade. But recently, just in the last few days, a group of people got together under the auspices of the British Academy and tried and sent the Queen a letter, and that's what's been reported in an attempt to answer this question, which has generated some commentary, including this cartoon from a Canadian newspaper, which I think probably is enough on that question. Now, some may argue that now we're 2 years into the crisis, and indeed attention is focused on finding routes out of it and on whether the green shoots of recovery are now visible, such a retrospective approach as the whodunit question is appropriate. Why should we now engage in a useless blame game? Isn't this an exercise in touring the battlefield after the action is over, bayoneting the wounded? Well, I don't think so, because I think this is not an ordinary crisis. The financial and economic costs are enormous. The overt cost of the financial rescues is now estimated at around $9 trillion in the US, Europe, and Japan. In the UK alone, this is now the fourth most expensive fiscal event in British history after the Napoleonic Wars and the two world wars of the 20th century. As far as ordinary people are concerned, we've still not seen anything like the full implications. Unemployment's rising sharply across the developed world, will almost certainly continue to do so for some time. In New Zealand, it's forecast to go above 7% next year, twice the rate before the crisis began. And I don't think this is a situation in which we can say, no worries, we all make mistakes and move on. Also, I think a clear analysis of the causes of the crisis is needed in order to inform the solutions. And my impression is that in some of the current international debates, politicians are proposing solutions in search of problems. I would put the Franco-German initiatives to rein in hedge funds and private equity firms in this category. I think the same is true of the G20 focus on offshore centres. There may be reasons to wish to tighten up in these areas, and, of course, it's important not to waste a good crisis, but they are hardly at the centre of the problem. So I think it does remain worthwhile to try to refine our analysis of what went wrong. But before I begin to throw stones, let me describe for you the glass house in which I live. In other words, let me take my share of the blame before dishing out the rest. I was deputy governor, as Alan said, in the mid-90s, and chairman of the FSA until the summer of 2003. Now, I think I would argue that it was too soon then to identify this inflating bubble, but I would certainly accept that when I was a regulator, I shared the view that the financial system, particularly the banking system, could operate with relatively low levels of capital, and also the view that financial innovation was by and large a good thing. And those assumptions have now been challenged. Since 2003, I've been director of the LSE, and it's arguable that the economic profession and economic teaching has not been without fault. In a lecture at the LSE last month, Paul Krugman argued that for the last 30 years, macroeconomics has been passing through what he called a dark age. One of our own professors, Willem Bouter, wrote a blog in the FT recently entitled "The Unfortunate Uselessness of Most State-of-the-Art Monetary Economics." His argument was that economists have become so preoccupied with growth theory that they've lost interest in the financial sector and in the analysis of economic cycles. They've ignored asset prices, partly because they had too much faith in the efficiency of financial markets. And this is a difficult charge to refute convincingly. Finally, since 2004, perhaps Alan was just being too kind not to mention this, I have been a member of the board and indeed of the audit committee of Morgan Stanley in the United States. Morgan Stanley has not been the worst affected bank in this crisis, but certainly it was caught up in the enthusiasm of some of the markets that went pop. And I shall have something to say about the responsibility of boards of financial institutions in a minute. So that's where I'm coming from, so to speak. My analysis is therefore from a hybrid insider-outsider perspective. One rather depressing feature of many current analyses of the causes of the crisis is that people are now retreating into the positions they held before it started. For a time, there were signs of a rather open debate, with financial firms and even politicians showing remarkable open-mindedness and willingness to challenge received opinions. But now the initial shock is fading. So the Wall Street Journal editorial pages have concluded that they were right all along and that the problem was excessive government intervention in the markets. Politicians on the left have decided that they were right all along in believing that unbridled capitalism carried within it the seeds of its own destruction. The French have decided that it's the fault of the Anglo-Saxons in New York and especially London. The English have decided, with some justification, that the real villains of the peace were Scottish bankers. The Tories think the only villain is a Scottish Prime Minister. No doubt in New Zealand, there are those who blame all your economic ills on your trans-Tasman cousins. The Australians themselves, as is their wont, blame the umpires. Now, what do ordinary people think? Well, they seem to have a fairly balanced view. A British financial website shows a good distribution of responsibility with all the main suspects named. Bankers take pride of place, and I wouldn't wish to do anything to deny them that accolade. But there are some more wacky claims around. The Scientific American has argued that it's to do with testosterone, often a handy culprit, though I'm quite keen on testosterone myself. But a recent Boston Globe survey, Boston Globe's newspaper, showed that 25% of Americans and 32% of Democrats polled believed the crisis was caused largely by the Jews. And one Oxford professor has advanced the theory that the roots of the crisis lie in violent video games. The inhabitants of trading rooms have been brought up in a kind of virtual reality mode whereby you can play dangerous games on screen causing death and destruction without any risk of genuine harm to yourself. And the same philosophy carries over into their trading strategies. Actually, that theory may not be as wacky as it sounds, but I'm not proposing to dwell on it this evening. Instead, let me try a heroic attempt to produce a summary of the crisis in about 90 seconds, which should be enough for a pretty comprehensive analysis. The crisis was triggered by a re-rating of risk in financial markets, first of the subprime market in the United States. That re-rating pushed down the prices of bonds and other financial assets and generated losses which were too large to be absorbed by the financial system, which had too little capital. The risk that many financial institutions would therefore go bankrupt generated panic, which triggered a collapse in credit, which spread the crisis beyond the markets where it started and caused a general collapse in economic confidence and then in economic growth. Now, the collapse was all the more severe because it had been preceded by a massive expansion in credit and in asset prices, especially in the housing markets in the US and elsewhere. So we have to ask why those credit and housing bubbles inflated in the first place. And I think behind them, we can see the impact of what was called the Great Moderation, which caused policymakers to believe that productivity growth had jumped to a new trajectory. The emergence of huge global imbalances, especially between China and the oil exporters on the one hand, and that's the bars above the line. China is the blue one and the oil exporters is the sort of tasteful burgundy one. Those huge surpluses were balanced by large deficits by the US in the green and the UK, the sort of pink one at the bottom. Those surpluses produced huge accumulations of reserves which had to be invested, which bid up the prices of risky assets and lowered real and nominal interest rates. The export of these huge capital surpluses and the emergence of highly competitive imports from China in particular held down inflation. Monetary policy, which focused narrowly on consumer price inflation, was therefore weak and accommodating. One economist has quipped that the CPI was really Chinese price inflation during this period, in that it was reflecting the impact of a huge influx of new workers in China prepared to work for very low rates of pay and joining the formal economy, which they had been outside in the past. In this environment of excess liquidity and very easy credit, borrowers went on a borrowing binge. Companies increased their leverage, and particularly households borrowed more and more, so that household debt rose to unprecedented levels in relation to GDP, even higher in the UK, as you can see, which is the darker bar, than in the US. This is an explanation, one of the explanations, for the rather difficult position we now find ourselves in. Banks and other financial firms were happy to accommodate this demand for credit and were prepared to lend even to very risky and vulnerable borrowers. In the US especially, bank assets and bank leverage rose very sharply. This shows the total assets of banks, and the line is the ratio between assets and tangible book value of banks. And securitizations added another massive source of credit creation, which were off banks' balance sheets. The so-called parallel banking system went into overdrive. So where were the regulators while all this was happening? Well, they were worrying away, of course, as regulators do, but regulation did not act as an effective brake on this set of bubbles and rapid expansion. Indeed, regulation operated in a pro-cyclical way, with banks allowed to hold less capital as booming asset prices shielded them from losses. And regulatory arbitrage drove the expansion in off-balance sheet credit. The whole edifice came crashing down beginning in the summer of 2007. One vivid measure of that was the total collapse of the securitisation market, which, as you could see, had been rocketing upwards in terms of volumes of issues up to the beginning of 2008 and then essentially closed down. Financial markets generally seized up. A number of very large banks folded entirely and economic growth collapsed. This is the IMF World Economic Outlook. I regard the latter part of this as somewhat speculative, we shall see, but the scale of the collapse in growth is pretty striking. Since then, governments have been trying to stave off the threat of depression and have probably succeeded in doing so. Central banks have flooded the market with liquidity and pushed interest rates down. Governments have allowed fiscal deficits to balloon, but we're left, of course, with two big headaches. First, how to exit from the very expansionary monetary and fiscal policies, and particularly how to restore some health to the damaged public finances, and, of course, what should be done to improve the robustness of the financial system in the future.
Now, if this analysis is broadly correct, then it points to a number of the problems we need to resolve. In the first place, it does suggest that there was a problem with the construction of both monetary and fiscal policies in the run-up to the crisis, and maybe in some cases with exchange rates too. It looks as though the renminbi-dollar rate should have been higher, and that's something which successive US Treasury secretaries argued, but to little effect. And in a sense, both the Americans and the Chinese enjoyed the unbalanced relationship I showed you a moment ago for different reasons. The Chinese could build up reserves, which make them feel more secure, and they were still learning the lessons of the last financial crisis, the Asian crisis of the late 90s, while the Americans could continue to live beyond their means. And we, the plucky Brits, tucked in behind them with this strategy. But starting at the exchange rate end of the story may not be appropriate. The key was that the US, and indeed the UK, were saving too little and spending too much. They were able to do so because monetary policy was loose. After the dot-com boom and bust, the Fed acted decisively to prevent that crisis turning into a recession, so interest rates were sharply reduced and held low for some years. One conventional measure of the appropriateness of monetary policy is something called the Taylor Rule, which relates the level of interest rates to inflation and capacity utilization in the economy, which in turn is a good indicator of price pressures. John Taylor himself, the inventor of the rule, has calculated that US interest rates were remarkably divergent from it from about 2002 to 2005, and he sees that as by a long way the most important cause of the crisis. Now, he may overstate the case a little, but I think he is broadly correct. So central bankers must take their place in our rogues gallery. And that's a statement which guarantees I won't be invited back to speak at the Reserve Bank's 150th anniversary, which otherwise I was rather hoping to do. But just because credit is available at an attractive price doesn't mean that banks have to lend to all the customers who ask for loans, or that customers are obliged to borrow. Individual economic actors, whether households or firms, are not just pawns in a central banker's chess game. So households and others must also take their share of responsibility. Certainly in the UK, we were living above our means, with a savings rate falling close to zero, a large balance of payments deficit, and rapidly growing public spending, with tax cuts implemented by the government in early 2007, worsening the fiscal position and fueling the biggest consumer boom we'd ever seen. In the US, similarly, the Bush administration's tax cuts gave a spending boost to high-income households, which worsened the financial imbalances further. Both individuals and governments enjoyed this period of expansion and the feel-good factor which it promoted. But there was a very heavy price to pay, and that's always the way with excess consumption, whether of cheap Chinese imported manufacturers or of expensive Hawke's Bay Pinot Noir. Now, it was perhaps natural for borrowers to wish to take advantage of these booming markets, but why were lenders so willing to lend with such gay abandon, and especially to people with very poor credit ratings? And that was the big story in the subprime market, as we're all familiar with. Well, political pressure was certainly part of the answer. Politicians saw great advantage in the expansion of home ownership and encouraged it. The two big government loan insurers, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the US, played their part, but I think they can't be held totally responsible for lax lending practices and for the total absence of discipline in that market. One important contributory factor was financial innovation. In the subprime sector, mortgage brokers, who were unregulated in the United States, would arrange 100% or indeed even more than 100% mortgages to borrowers with no credit records and often with no regular jobs. Indeed, they would often deliberately lend a bit more than 100% to allow the borrowers to pay interest for a few months, long enough to allow the loan to be securitized by the local bank and sold on to an investment bank, who then packaged it up in this exciting form and sliced it and diced it and sold it on once again, perhaps to a public sector bank in Germany. Securitisations were given fancy names like Super Senior AAA, helpfully provided by obliging rating agencies, and with the assistance of debt insurance provided by monoline insurance companies, who themselves were blown away in the first gales. This lengthy chain broke the normal crucial link between the lender and the borrower, in that the ultimate provider of finance had little or no knowledge of the ultimate user and believed that he was protected from default through a variety of essentially artificial constructs, which were soon revealed to be flimsy. And when the borrowers began to default because house prices stopped rising, the whole pack of cards collapsed. In fact, the best description of practices in this market comes in a play, which is also a film, called Glengarry Glen Ross by David Mamet, which was revived in London recently, which suggests that at least some theatrical impresario knows what's going on in financial markets. It was a huge hit. It's about mortgage brokers in Florida selling houses they've not seen to people they meet in Chinese restaurants. But that's exactly what was going on. The consequences were felt by institutions which had previously been regarded, and which certainly regarded themselves, as highly sophisticated. Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, UBS, Lehman Brothers, all suffered near-death experiences or indeed expired altogether. Evidently, the techniques of risk management in those institutions went badly wrong. Boards didn't exercise appropriate oversight. Incentive structures gave extravagant payments to individuals who structured these deals, while the deals themselves exposed their employers to huge losses in subsequent years. So boards of directors might say that their risk appetite was modest and under control, but they put in place incentive systems which pushed the firm into riskier strategies than they wanted. Well, that might be a kind way of putting it in the case of some institutions, and no doubt the G word, greed, entered the picture too. Finally, the regulators didn't offset this highly risky behaviour. Now, I don't ascribe as much power to regulators as some commentators and politicians do. Having been one for some years, I'm uncomfortably conscious of the difficulty a regulator has in fighting against a tide of market sentiment. When regulators seek to step in when the party's going strong, they're accused of being box-ticking, red-tape-spinning wet blankets who are constraining the animal spirits of the wealth-creating sector. Also, their tools are quite weak. They are nothing like as powerful as monetary policy in affecting credit conditions. A touch on the tiller in the form of a modestly higher capital requirement may have some impact, but it's not front page news like a hike in interest rates. All that said, there is, as I mentioned briefly at the beginning, powerful evidence to suggest that the capital ratios which regulators imposed were, in retrospect, too low. In particular, there was too little capital to back the trading books of banks who were trading in all of these derivative instruments. And the methodology used to assess capital requirements tended to be backward-looking. Regulators typically approach setting capital requirements by taking a bank's current book of assets and asking what the losses on that book would have been had it been held in that form over the previous decade or so. And since we'd had a decade of rising property and asset prices in benign economic conditions, this analysis typically told banks that capital requirements could be quite low, and that didn't turn out, of course, to be the right answer. Finance ministries and central banks set the speed limits, run the petrol stations, and determine the octane of the petrol available. Regulators can nonetheless try to ensure that high-performance vehicles don't skid off the road, and were clearly ineffective in that. Now, I hope it's clear from this analysis that we have quite a complex failure on our hands, and that makes designing solutions rather complex too. I don't think we can take refuge in the certainties offered by finding a single scapegoat, the greedy banker, the feckless borrower, the regulator asleep at the switch, the insouciant governor, or whoever.
Far be it from me to wish to take anything away from our Prime Minister, but even he could not create this Horlicks single-handed. Now, I suggest, therefore, there are six areas in which system improvements are needed. In some of them, progress is already underway. In others, I think there's a lot of work still to do. The first area concerns monetary policy, which, of course, is the core business of our hosts. We need to find a way of putting financial markets, credit and asset prices back at the centre of monetary policy. Analysts at the Bank for International Settlements, for example, have argued for some time that central banks should take more account of asset prices and seek to lean against the wind of credit and asset price growth. In recent years, some central banks, notably Sweden, have justified increases in interest rates that way, but the prevailing orthodoxy in the Federal Reserve, and indeed the Bank of England, has meant that monetary policy should focus on retail price inflation and that it's idle to pretend that central bankers can identify asset price bubbles in advance. The best they can do, according to Alan Greenspan, is to mop up afterwards. My own view is that this isn't adequate and that we cannot simply accept that crises on the scale we've seen in the last 2 years are part of the price we pay for doing business. Now, quite how to integrate credit and asset analysis and inflation target framework is not wholly straightforward, but I think it can be done. There may, from time to time, be a growth trade-off, I acknowledge. Central banks everywhere are gearing up their financial stability arms, but many talk as though financial stability analysis is designed only to feed into decisions taken by regulators in relation to capital. And that's the case whether those regulators are part of the central bank, as here, or outside it, as in the UK or Australia. In my view, this financial stability analysis must look two ways, that it might point to monetary policy action as well as to changes in bank capital. That links to the second area, which has been intensely discussed in international fora in recent months. The conventional wisdom now has it that within financial regulation, we should distinguish between macroprudential and microprudential actions. In the past, I think we didn't have this bifurcation in our minds. Macroprudential oversight is intended to look at the state of financial markets overall. So if you think that the housing market is overvalued generally, you might apply a market supplement to the reserves mortgage banks must hold. Indeed, if you think that credit overall is too loose, you might apply a market supplement even more generally. And that would be over and above the assessments that you would make of the particular balance sheet of the particular institution you're looking at. But the point of macroprudential supplements is to constrain credit growth, and they will in practice largely do so through increasing the price. Because the more reserves a bank must hold, which are not earning a return for the given amount of lending, the higher the cost of that lending will turn out to be. So if that is the point of macroprudential requirements, then we need to weigh an increase in capital against an overall rise in interest rates, which would have a similar effect. The point of both measures would be to inject some counter-cyclical element to financial regulation. In other words, we'd be trying to get banks to salt away larger reserves in the good times so they're more robust when the cycle turns down. And nobody thinks we can abolish the economic cycle. Gordon Brown famously talked of having put an end to boom and bust, but that trope has disappeared from his political vocabulary in the last 2 years. This complex relationship between monetary policy and regulation points to the need for greater coordination between central banks, regulators where they're separate, and finance ministries. We might add other reasons to justify stronger collaborative mechanisms. The global imbalances story I told earlier, which was one of the major long-term causes of the crisis, clearly had fiscal and exchange rate dimensions to it, which are well beyond the normal concerns of regulators. So globally, we need stronger collaborative structures, and they need to be buttressed by regional and domestic arrangements which feed into them. Before the crisis, the global regulatory system was hopelessly complex with no central authority. This is as simplified a slide as you can produce of the way in which the different bodies which set the rules for the financial sector interact with each other. And the one thing that you will notice is every body has a dotted line to every other. In other words, nobody is in charge of anybody. Now, on that front, some progress has been made. In fact, none of these bodies have yet been abolished, but in place of the Financial Stability Forum, there is now a Global Financial Stability Board, which was agreed at the April G20 summit, which includes the central banks, regulators, and finance ministries of all the major countries, and indeed some minor ones too, since it's been extended to the G20. That's probably, frankly, too large a grouping to be effective, but sadly the G7 tried to cling on to a monopoly of power for too long, which meant that when they brought in others, they had to bring in more countries than they really wanted to. In Europe, there will be a European Systemic Risk Board, chaired by the President of the European Central Bank. Beneath that, in the UK, for example, there'll be a Domestic Financial Stability Committee. The Labour Party says it'll be chaired by the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Conservatives say it'll be chaired by the Governor. All of these bodies will have their own staff and analysis and publish their own reviews. Indeed, financial stability, along with violent video games, is one of the few growth industries at the moment. The fourth area, where it's harder to discern concrete change, concerns our overall attitude to financial innovation. Hitherto, in the major financial centres, governments and their regulators have generally taken a permissive approach to financial innovation. In other words, if new instruments are created which allow more sophisticated trading of financial claims, then in principle they should be allowed to go ahead unless they're obviously dangerous. Now, that principle doesn't apply so rigorously in retail markets, where we believe a greater degree of consumer protection is needed. But if consenting adults, and until the crisis we used to regard the big banks as adults, wish to operate complex trading strategies between themselves, who are regulators to argue that they shouldn't be allowed to do so? The economic justification for this approach was that the more flexible and financial markets become, the better that is for economic growth and for long-term welfare. Now, I think the crisis has challenged that comfortable assumption. Financial innovation now appears to have brought with it much greater systemic vulnerability. We can't definitely prove this, but it would seem that we've created a system where even if it has generated greater economic growth, the price is much greater volatility. We shouldn't forget, of course, that the period up to this crisis was one of unparalleled prosperity, with an extended spurt in economic growth, which made some people very wealthy indeed, but which bolstered the living standards of the middling sort of people, like most of the population of New Zealand, and also pulled millions of people out of grinding poverty in China, India, and elsewhere. So there is a baby and bathwater point here. We must be careful not to constrain financial markets in a way which prevents them performing their essential economic function. But it seems at least arguable that we must question the value of some forms of financial innovation more sharply than we've done in the past. These instruments, if you like, are like fireworks. They produce very pretty displays, but in the wrong hands, they can blow up in your face. I might at this point make just a brief excursion into happiness economics, which is now studied at the LSE. What makes people happy? Well, if you have no money at all, then earning some is likely to improve your view of the world. But beyond a certain level of income, the correlation between wealth and well-being is quite loose. This has income per head on the bottom axis, and the average of percentage happy and percentage satisfied with their lives, and there are some quite consistent opinion polls on the other side. You will see from this that New Zealand, you can find sort of in the top of the middle, is not as wealthy as, say, Japan. But you are happier. Why is this? If you draw a line through there, you can see that you're quite an outlier above this, along with Mexico. I have no hypothesis whatsoever to explain that. Perhaps you can reflect on it with your tacos this evening. Also, most people prefer a more stable economic environment to one with high peaks and very low troughs. The economic, social and personal costs of bouts of high unemployment are very large. I think if you could reliably offer the population a choice between, say, growth of 2.5% a year with modest ups and downs, or growth of 2.75% a year with occasional chronic booms and busts, they might well choose the former. Furthermore, we know that people do not like very wide income inequalities, which the financial boom also generated. So against that background, we must adopt a more questioning approach to financial innovation in the future. At the moment, of course, the major banks, investment banks and hedge funds are shying away from innovation, but that phase will pass, and in the longer term we will have to depend on regulators to question the benefits of innovation where they don't seem very closely related to customer needs, as was true of some of the instruments recently created. There is, I should say, however, no international consensus on this point yet, and not a lot of economic research which helps you answer it. Fifth, we have to find ways of strengthening the governance of financial institutions themselves. Regulation will always be a backstop. Firms themselves have a responsibility to safeguard their shareholders, and arguably, boards have done rather badly against that yardstick, whether it's at Citigroup, the Royal Bank of Scotland, Fortis, or wherever. There are some interesting ideas now emerging, notably from a review by David Walker of corporate governance in banks in the UK, which I think should be taken forward. Overall, there'll be a need for greater independence, greater expertise, and greater scepticism on financial firms' boards in the future. Non-executive directors will certainly have to spend more time on the job. Lastly, to bring things back to earth with a bump, there is a need for better understanding of finance on the part of the population as a whole. It's striking just how extended many households had allowed themselves to become. Stories that have emerged of people with mortgages of 5 or 6 times their income, with negative net worth, or people buying doubtful properties in Spain and hoping to live there on a tiny British pension without paying any attention to exchange rate risk, are quite alarming. Financial capability has been neglected for a long time. When I was a regulator, I used to often say in speeches that I was married to prudence, which happens, in fact, to be true. Gordon Brown had an affair with her in his early years as Chancellor of the Exchequer, but he unceremoniously dumped her in 2001. In the boom, few people invited her out. In the aftermath of the crisis, many more people are now eyeing her up. But will it be a one-night stand or a long relationship? This crisis has been, for anyone in financial markets or in the financial authorities, no end of a lesson. Some regulators, some firms, some countries have done better than others, and that's true in this part of the world. But nobody has been spared the consequences entirely. And we know from the 20s and 30s that an inadequate response to crisis can generate very dangerous political consequences. That was the best justification for the dramatic measures taken by governments in the last 2 years. But even so, one can still see signs of political discontent of a rather dangerous kind. The recent European elections saw a burst of interest in fringe parties, some of them with highly unpleasant nationalistic and racist views, views which always find more fertile soil at times of economic disruption. So there is a very strong political stability, as well as a financial stability argument for a major effort to learn the lessons and rebuild the frameworks of capitalism and the fundamentals of finance. The risks of failure in this endeavour are very high indeed. Now, I'm sorry that in trying to answer my whodunit question. I haven't produced one simple explanation like Professor Plum with the candlestick in the library, or one name like Alan Greenspan, Chuck Prince, Hank Paulson, Fred Goodwin, Rudy Kurtzen, Mathieu Bastereau. But life is not so simple. Fortunately, there is plenty of red ink to share around, but I do apologise if I have inadvertently splattered my hosts. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Howard, for a very interesting talk. We've got time for questions. Who would like to offer a question? Thank you. You may have to shout out a bit so we can all hear.
Daniel Farley, Howard, would you regard banks in the same category as water companies, that they are too essential to go down?
I don't think that I would regard all banks in that category, but I think that the experience of allowing Lehman Brothers, for example, to fail has taught us some lessons about the interconnectedness of the financial system, which perhaps we hadn't appreciated as well as we might have done in advance. And therefore, I think the reality is that probably the category of financial institutions where allowing them to fail would cause more trouble than saving them is probably rather larger than we thought before the crisis began. Now, that leads, of course, into the question of what you should do about that. And in theory, you can go in one of two directions. You can pull back and say, you know, we are not going to rescue you and you're on your own. I think the difficulty with that is that markets will tend to pay more attention to what the authorities do than to what they say. And what the authorities have done is, in fact, in many countries, to draw a line under the whole banking system and say we stand behind it, either by guaranteeing its borrowing or by a blanket guarantee on deposits. Different techniques have been tried in different places. And I think getting away from that will take a long time. And credibly withdrawing implicit government support will be very, very hard indeed. Which leads me to the conclusion that rather than try quickly to say, off you go, we're stopping guaranteeing your borrowing, you're now on your own and you're totally, you know, you can fail, since I don't think that will be entirely believed, I think we have to work on making these banks safer. In other words, that we will have to require them to hold more capital than they used to hold, and that will make credit somewhat more expensive in the medium to long term, but will reduce the risk of further taxpayer bailouts for banks. Now, in the very long term, it would be wonderful if we did get back to a system without moral hazard and in which the banks, you know, genuinely had a risk to fail and looked after themselves. But I think realistically that's going to take quite a long time to get to, given all the things that have been done, certainly in the US and in the UK. And that's why I think that the strengthening capital requirements route is probably the best way to go at the moment.
How do you see the banks, or rather the governments and banks together, pulling back on the huge amount of liquidity being pumped into the international economy? In the case of the UK, the Bank of England has approval to buy up to £150 billion worth of open market securities, and If they're buying in a low interest environment, they'll be paying a premium. They sell out in a higher interest environment, they'll be making a capital loss. How is this going to be managed?
With great care. As the Bank of England always does these things. No, you point to a very difficult conundrum. I do think it will be possible to exit when the economy recovers. I mean, I don't think it's technically impossible to do. Indeed, the Fed has been talking extensively about this. Bill Dudley made an interesting speech about it just day before yesterday, I think. So I don't think it's technically impossible. And I think the key thing is market confidence, really, rather than the sort of technical nature of it. It may well be that the central banks make some losses in this process, but I think it probably will have been worth it unless those losses are extravagantly large. So I think what we must hope is that, as it were, normal credit conditions resume and that it will be possible then for the central banks gradually to withdraw from this process. But as you say, it is going to be quite risky.
I was curious, in your list of six things to do, you paid no attention to a particular problem of the US, which being the international issuer of the medium, the issuer of the international medium exchange, seems to me to require some particular consideration.
Sorry, in what? In what sense?
Everyone uses dollars. So the bank, the world banking system is dependent on the US dollar. As long as the... And so therefore, unless you get the medium of exchange right and regulate that differently, then in fact you have an international problem. And so that means that one has to think carefully. I'm not necessarily saying it was all their fault. One has to think carefully about the US system as the issue of the international medium and the change.
Yes. I agree with that proposition. Of course, the conventional observation is that the US dollar is their currency but our problem. In a sense, that's what you're saying, I guess. I certainly think that the US has one, of course, particular advantage in that it's able to borrow entirely in its own currency and, you know, to some extent because of its particular role in the global system. Countries don't have any alternative but to invest in or to hold a lot of their assets in dollars. And you can see with the Chinese are huffing and puffing about it, and they say they don't really like it and they worry about it, but nonetheless they aren't doing anything different, actually. I think what I do worry about, and perhaps this is behind your question, is that while the UK government has spent quite a bit of time and effort in explaining some of the things it would do to get out of the large fiscal deficit position that we're in, and some measures have already been pre-announced, you know, tax increases from next January, VAT goes back up, and marginal tax rates rise really quite sharply next April, in order to try to give confidence to the market that there is some kind of exit strategy from this fiscal problem that we've got into. The Americans don't seem terribly interested in that at this point. They don't seem to be concerned about showing a route out, even though their fiscal deficit is about the same as ours. Now, I think that in the central bank, in the Fed, I think they understand this problem very well, and there is a kind of political obstacle, really, to doing so at the moment. But I do agree with the implication of your question that the US will have to put its own house in order fairly soon as well, and will have to do something on the fiscal front, because otherwise, you know, they're going to be, well, they'll be taxing the rest of us, if you like, by a constantly weakening dollar, in which many other people hold their reserves. So I do hope that the new administration accepts its responsibilities in that area and does achieve some fiscal retrenchment, and not try to solve its problems by just taxing the rest of the world who hold dollars.
For the House at the moment, which calls for audit of the private Federal Reserve. Do you think that is interfering with monetary policy?
Ron Paul doesn't believe in central banks, and has made it clear that, you know, he really essentially favours sort of, you know, free banking. And so I think the motives of that piece of legislation are not perhaps entirely constructive in relation to the Federal Reserve. I do think, however, that I doubt if that legislation will get through, and I think it's conceived as a kind of debating point, as a lot of congressional legislation is. I do think, however, that there is an issue of an accountability question in relation to a central bank which is incurring significant fiscal costs. And I think that the independence framework and the independence cocoon, if you like, that we've put around central banks in relation to monetary policy doesn't really work if they are effectively engaged in fiscal policy, where different kinds of structures of accountability, I think, are required. So in that sense, I think he's got a point, that somehow there needs to be a different type of holding the Fed to account, where effectively it's spending US taxpayers' money, from when it's administering short-term interest rates to achieve an inflation objective, which itself has been legislated. So I do think there is an issue there, but I'm not sure that his particular bill is likely to be the way of dealing with it.
In your opening address, you alluded to the fact that you were concerned that the good times were back here again, and obviously concerns arise over compensation packages. You see some pretty healthy compensation packages arise at the moment, with RBS getting £10 million, Goldman Sachs introducing bonus of $1 million. Don't you think it's time perhaps for their regulators to step in and have some control over the short term until we get over this sea crisis?
Well, the FSA has done so. I think the difficulty is to work out what is the legitimate concern for regulators and what is the legitimate concern essentially for the tax authorities, you know, which are two potentially different answers. I think that the legitimate concern for regulators is where compensation, as the Americans euphemistically call it, is driving risky behavior which is incompatible with the institution's overall risk management strategy, if you like. And there clearly have been cases where that's so, where people have been paid extravagant sums for short-term profits, which themselves have put the institution at risk. So that's, I think, the focus. I think there's also legitimate interest in guaranteed bonuses, you know, which strike me as being generally a pernicious thing. And so what is going on in London, certainly, is that the FSA is focusing on those two things, on guaranteed bonuses and on bonuses which are paid out on short-term profits, but where actually the position taken on, you know, may have longer-term losses. And I think it's right that regulators should insist that these compensation packages are structured in a way that more aligns the returns to the individual with the overall risks to the institution. Now, whether the tax authorities want to do more than that, and indeed in the US, of course, there is already a limit on tax relief for high salaries, which has an impact. And in the UK, of course, top marginal tax rates are going up from 40 to 50 next April on incomes over £150,000. You know, that strikes me as being justifiable too, but justifiable in relation to a different set of arguments, really, rather than to do with the risk management of institutions. It's to do with, you know, the appropriate contribution these people should make to the public welfare. So I do think it's important to sort of try to pick your way carefully through this set of issues. I mean, I think actually the RBS package has been restructured beyond the point that it's not straightforwardly £10 million for Stephen Hester. He has restructured that.
Carry on. You suggested that this experience might call into question inflation targeting as a child of central banks. What kind of reassessment did you have in mind?
I didn't think I meant to say that inflation targeting itself was a bad thing. I said it needed some additional sophistication in relation to asset prices and credit growth. Personally, I'm quite attracted to the way the ECB thinks about these things, where they have a second monetary pillar, which they were criticised for at the outset, but I think has actually proved to be quite useful for them, where they also, you know, they have an inflation target effectively. It's not quite called that, but it is effectively. But they also monitor monetary growth and effectively credit growth and look at that alongside. That's one way of thinking about it. Another way of thinking about it is to legislate, as the government have done in the UK, to give the bank a formal financial stability objective, which might then cause you on occasion to change rates not solely with a justification related to a short-term inflation target. Another approach is, of course, to lengthen the horizon of the inflation target. Typically, people have tended to talk about these things on a relatively short-term horizon. So, to make this slightly more practical, I think there could be circumstances in which you might be in a position where the CPI was still subdued, capacity utilization was still low, but where you were seeing asset price bubbles, perhaps because credit conditions were very weak, and you might justify an interest rate rise perhaps rather earlier than might appear to be justified by your simple inflation target in relation to asset price rises. So I think there are various different ways in which you can add some notion of asset prices and credit growth to the inflation target framework. But I wouldn't personally, well, some people do want to chuck out inflation targets, but I personally wouldn't. I personally would keep an inflation target framework, but try to add some elements of asset price and credit to them.
At the start, you mentioned the House of Cards. And is it the entire system at fault here with fractionalised reserve banking? The banks in times of banking get by very well,
that when things go awry, the governments, the central banks, prop them up. But by their very nature, banks have to continue to expand the return to their shareholders. Aren't we just trying to reset the pack of cards? It's a bit like the Titanic going down, the music being played, and the band says, well, the waltz didn't work, maybe the foxtrot might be better off.
Well, I'm not sure where that leads you. I mean, the alternatives are not hugely attractive. Social credit's been tried, but it's never been a great hit. It's quite constraining in terms of financing economic growth. So, although in some ways I would say that in terms of the rethinking that I need, I would position myself perhaps towards the more radical end of the spectrum in terms of rethinking our approach to financial innovation, rethinking our approach to inflation targeting, etc. I do think we are engaged in a major refurbishment job of market capitalism, rather than thinking of a completely different approach. Now, that's my view. I may be wrong, but I think we could reconstruct this pack of cards with stronger cards made of firmer cardboard, perhaps a bit of glue from time to time, and I think that could do the job. And I'm influenced in that by not knowing what the alternative really is, actually.
Sorry, we're having trouble hearing. Can you shut up?
And he's pointing towards thermodynamics as an example of the way energy flows through networks. And his argument is that why don't we look towards examples like Ver in Switzerland, which has survived 75 years and done very well, and it seems to prosper during times where there's been a downturn that's been studied too. And he's looking towards complementary currencies rather than staying with fractional reserve banking, which is basically a monopoly and a subsidy on the issuance of money out of the new.
I don't think it'll work. I've seen some of those arguments and they are kind of interesting theoretical points, but, I can't see. Maybe I lack imagination, but I can't see any appetite among the world's governments to encourage the development of complementary currencies. I just don't, and I also find it very difficult to see how you would create the broad confidence in them needed to make a significant impact on financial intermediation. So I think these can be helpful ways of thinking about the problems, and I think the ways in which he talks about, the dynamics of financial systems, I think are, can be helpful devices for thinking about the way in which problems develop. But I don't personally think that complementary currencies are a runner.
Thank you. We've time for one last question. Go ahead.
Yeah, just wondering, where's the money gone, or was there none in the first place?
He's got it. In some cases, curiously enough, the second part of your point might be right. I mean, someone has calculated that in the last year of its independent existence, Merrill Lynch lost more than it had ever made in all the previous years of its existence. And so in that sense, it was a kind of self-extinguishing venture. But the more serious answer is that where the money has gone, certainly in the UK context, is that there has been a serious growth. I mean, we've already lost 5.3% of GDP and we will lose more, and a serious hole to fill in the financial system. And ordinary people will pay, because over the next few years we will have to reduce our fiscal deficit, probably in the end run some fiscal surpluses, and people will experience lower living standards as a result. Now, you might say, and I think I probably would say, that in a sense, and that is a compensation, if you like, or paying the price of having had very much higher living standards over the previous decade, where people had actually been living above their means. In the UK, we had growth of 1% higher a year than the French and the Germans over the last decade, and that was in fact funded by this. We were just borrowing more money and spending it. And that was great, but actually it won't carry on because of the crisis. You can't carry on doing that. There will be a deleveraging. And so, curiously, there will be a sort of intergenerational transfer. Now, if you're sort of, between 30 and 50 in this process, you're from 30 to 40, you'll do jolly well, and 40 to 50, you'll do less well. That may be sort of okay. But there is a curious intergenerational transfer gone on. The people who have been living up to now have done actually very well, and there will be a price now to pay for quite some time to come. That's the best answer I can give you, really.
Thank you, Howard. As you're possibly aware, there's a bit of a question being asked in this town at the minute about who really does have a PhD from London School of Economics and who doesn't. But I'm very pleased to say that I'm now going to call on someone who undoubtedly does, the chairman of the board of the Reserve Bank, Dr. Arthur Grimes, who will have a vote for that.
It's a great pleasure to be able to thank Howard Davies for what was a very stimulating but also very entertaining speech. And he started out by talking about some of the links between New Zealand and the London School of Economics, talking about Bill Phillips. And, of course, we ran a major international conference here last year in honour of Bill Phillips, which was a fabulous occasion and helped by the LSE. The links actually go back a lot further than that. For those who know the New Zealand history, the Liberal government, elected in 1891, had one extreme sort of radical member, William Pember Reeves, and he was shunted off to London as our agent general, and subsequently became the director, same role that Howard does have now, and he was the director of the LSE from 1908 to 1919. So we have very long links. There's been very close links since then between the LSE, the Bank of England, and the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. My mentor, I suppose, when I first came to the bank, Grant Spencer, who's now Deputy Governor, attended the LSE, studied there, sent me off to study there. Others from the bank have studied there as well. So it's been a long and fruitful association. It's also been a very fruitful association with the staff, both of the LSE and the Bank of England. Charles Goodhart, who was at the Bank of England, moved to the LSE, moved back to the Bank of England. Very, very good friend of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. And right through that period of the 1970s, 80s, 90s, Charles was one of the people that we always went to in terms of advice, helped advise us on the Reserve Bank Act in the 80s, etc. And since then, people like Mervyn King and Charles Bean have been flitting between the LSE, the Bank of England, and have also been very good friends of the Reserve Bank. So it's fantastic that tonight we could have somebody who's had the links between the Bank of England, the LSE and also the FSA, which puts you one up from all those other people, and to be able to come out and talk to us. You talked about the difficulty of regulating, as you know, from the central bank, we know those difficulties. You talked about poor savings records. We could only dream about savings records of 0%. You know, we had a household savings ratio of minus 14%. So you think you had problems. And I was fascinated, as somebody who'd been involved in inflation targeting, about your discussion of the inflation targeting issues. Interestingly, our Act, written back in the 80s, is not quite so specific as some people think. It says that the Reserve Bank has to achieve stability in the general level of prices. And it was deliberately left vague to be able to include things like asset price targeting there, as well as consumer price targeting. So that the Act is left somewhat vague on that issue. Your talk was fascinating. I found it really interesting to when you got onto the happiness subject. Lord Layard, who taught me at LSE and then became a Buddhist and got into happiness, he's done some fantastic work on this. And recently, just in fact in the last month, we had a professor from Imperial College out here, Robert McCulloch, who's been doing a lot of work with his colleague Rafael Dottella from Harvard on happiness economics and relating it to central banking. And he actually presented a paper here last month showing that the happiness within a country over time varies according to both unemployment and inflation. So the higher the rate of inflation in the country, the lower the level of happiness, and there's quite a robust relationship over time. So linking back to some of Bill Phillips's sort of trade-off ideas. And interestingly, Robert started his career at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand before he went to London. So these links between London, Bank of England, LSE, Reserve Bank, they go back a very long way, and it's just been an absolute pleasure, Howard, to have you here talking to us tonight. Thank you.